Okay. Pleased to see people here today to start discussing not a major issue, to start discussing what's a really important issue of the future and to trying to take a futuristic picture of this. We'll take the clerks will take the role visually, and I think we have enough people to start, and I think we'll start. Welcome to this joint committee, which has never met before. First inaugural meeting of this terrific team. So nice to face this other terrific team. And let's begin.
Good morning, Madam Chairman. Tom Gillespie and I are going to do like we normally do, and that's kind of, is the sound on here, or can you?
I think it's mainly for recording. Does it,
is that okay?
Get
that better? That's better.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. We'll we have a joint presentation. We'll alternate back and forth a little bit here, although we're going to try and keep our remarks brief this morning. There are three parts to the presentation. First, I want to give you just a real quick update on the current economic outlook. We do not have the Global Insight forecast that we'll be using in the revenue forecast. We expect to get that today or tomorrow, but we do have some additional information, and I'll talk about that a little bit. But then most of the time, we want to spend discussing some important demographic challenges that are going to face the state over the next few years. We've told you before that we believe that the states and the firms that best deal with these challenges are going to be the most successful looking on out into the future, and we think it's an important area for public policy to be considering in the mid-21st century, or the early 21st century. And then finally, we're going to conclude with a couple of items we believe are cause for concern. In fact, might even be downright scary. With that, let me start with the short-term outlook. There are lots of questions out there. You hear them all the time. Are we in a recession or not? Should the Fed cut rates some more or not? Is the fiscal stimulus package going to be effective or not? Questions are being asked in front of a backdrop that has gloomier and gloomier economic news. Now, not all economic news recently has been gloomy. There have been an occasional bright spot, but in total, you have to believe that the economic outlook has turned down a little bit. Fourth quarter GDP grew by only 0.6%. In November's forecast, we had 1.3% growth, but only grew about a half as fast as we thought it would. And normal growth is somewhere in the range of 2.7 to 3%. So this is quite slow growth. January jobs fell by 17,000 nationally. Normally, we'd expect to see about 150,000 increase. Something called the Institute for Supply Managers Services Index was reported yesterday. It was down dramatically. Most worrisome, there are a string of articles about the monoline insurers, companies called AMBAC and MDIC in particular. The question is whether their ratings are going to hold up or whether they're going to be downgraded. If they're downgraded, this is going to cause a very substantial repricing of all these financial instruments, collateralized debt obligations that were insured by them, because they'll no longer carry a AAA rating, and that could start the whole process of write-downs that we saw starting most visibly last summer over again. So that's the background news that we have. Here is a picture of January's baseline forecast from Global Insight and January's recession forecast for Global Insight. The probability that was attached to the baseline forecast was 50%. The probability that was attached to the recession forecast was 40%. I would have put the November forecast on here, but you couldn't have seen the difference. The November forecast that the revenue forecast is actually based on and the January baseline forecast are close enough that you can't tell much difference in there. The recession forecast, there's a couple of interesting things about it. One is obviously you see a shrinkage in the economy, not just slow growth, but the economy actually declines for three quarters. The declines aren't particularly large, however, it's a relatively mild recession. The second thing that you notice is that we don't ever start to grow as fast as within the baseline forecast through 2009 and actually through 2010. So that gap between the two lines at the top, that area is equivalent to what we might lose in revenue, that gap just keeps on growing in there. Yesterday there was additional news. It wasn't particularly good. Global Insight sent us a message yesterday afternoon or yesterday evening. They say now we expect that the economy will be in recession for at least the first half of the year, with the first and second quarters both showing negative growth. So what we're expecting to see today is something along the line of the blue bars, maybe a little bit more pessimistic in the short term even than is that. And so that almost certainly will create a situation where we will have less in the way of revenue. The question you and I and everybody has is, what about locally? Will Minnesota escape? And it's not likely that we're going to escape. There's a myth that Minnesota's diversified economy protects it from economic downturns. That's simply not true. The recession that we had in the 1980s, the two recessions that we had in the 1980s demonstrate that pretty well, since Minnesota suffered more than the national average. And the recession in the 1990s largely skipped Minnesota, but it was because the sectors that were hit were not particularly important in Minnesota. The 2001 recession was about average for Minnesota and the U.S. For 2007-2008, this recession looks more like it's going to be more severe than in the U.S. This is employment. We don't have gross state product data on a monthly basis, and so we can't show you how it's tracking the U.S. economy on a monthly or quarterly basis. But you can see that since the beginning of the year, the U.S. economy has grown by about 0.7% in employment, and Minnesota's employment has declined by about 0.4%. Now, there are always revisions to economic data, and there's a possibility that Minnesota's economic data, employment data, would be revised, and some of that decline would be taken away, and you can imagine that you might get rid of that spike in June. But even if the Minnesota employment data leaves Minnesota's employment flat across the whole year, that's still not a very good result. We should have added, if we'd have grown at the national rate, about 20,000 jobs. Existing data shows that between June and December, we lost more than 20,000 jobs. And existing data shows that we did not gain we actually lost jobs between January and December. If you look at Minnesota's unemployment rate, you can see, you just look at the numbers, that Minnesota's at 4.9%. In December, the U.S. number was at 5%. And you say, well, that's not quite as bad as the U.S. But this graph shows you that historically, Minnesota has been substantially lower than the U.S. unemployment rate. It's not until February of this year that Minnesota had ever had an unemployment rate that was equal to the U.S. Unemployment rate. In April, we actually exceeded it for the first time in recorded history. So that's certainly not something that we're looking forward to here. Final piece on the Minnesota economy shows you what's going on in housing, the housing outlook for Minnesota. In 2005, the fourth quarter, we had about 2,400 housing permits issued per month on average in the state. In 2007, the fourth quarter, we had only 800 a month. There's been a steeper decline in housing activity in Minnesota than nationally, and that's hurting our economic outlook as well. We're meeting with the council, our council of economic advisors, later this week to discuss the Global Insight forecast. The revenue forecast will be made available on the 28th, but I really don't see how we're going to avoid a further decline in revenues. How much? That's the big question. Let me conclude this section by saying the good thing about recessions is that they're short. They typically last 8 to 10 months, and we're probably already in it here, so we can see the light at the end of the tunnel, I think. Recessions also have effects that extend beyond financial markets. We lose about a year of growth in employment. We lose about a year of growth in incomes, and there are also demographic changes. Here's Tom to talk a little bit about those demographic changes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gillespie. I'm the Minnesota State Demographer in the Department of Administration. In the short run, economic forces exert strong influence on demographic change, and then as the time period expands, the demographic forces increasingly exert strong influence over economic change. One other element that we are faced with at this time, both in Minnesota and the United States, is that we are entering a period of what might be called an inflection point or a dramatic change in our society with a substantially different rate of growth in people achieving a certain age groups that have important implications for the workforce through retirement as well as Social Security, Medicaid, other health care kinds of issues. And so this is all happening at exactly the same time, and the short run is merging a bit with some of the longer run implications. In the short run, the current economic condition, the nature of the financial market, stock market, bond market, and other financial markets, the value of homes, the ability to sell a home, all may influence the rate of retirement that we see in our society, where some people may decide to delay their retirement decision and stay in the workforce longer if they can, if that is an option. It may also have an impact on movement of people, particularly around the retirement age, as the location decision, where would you like to live, may in part depend upon your ability to sell a house. And in a tight housing market, that decision may be greatly restricted, and the overall wealth of older households may be experiencing a decline at this time. The short run economic forces also affect migration largely through workforce decisions. Minnesota's ability to attract people from other states and other areas of the world has depended in large part on our relative performance relative to the rest of the country. When we outperform the nation, people tend to move to Minnesota, and we see an increase in migration levels. When we underperform the nation, we tend to see less in-migration, a little bit more out-migration, and the net flow slows down. During recessions, another element is that the mobility of the population tends to slow down substantially. There's just simply less moving about. The difficulty of finding new jobs increases, and also since many families are two-earner families, the difficulty of finding two jobs, of course, is multiplied over the difficulty of finding one job. The housing market will also further restrict this movement, and as a result, we believe that there will be in the short run reduced population growth in Minnesota with less in-migration and either flat or slightly increasing out-migration rates. Housing choices also, as people in the short run make longer run decisions at critical times in their life, younger families' ability to change their housing based upon their changing housing needs will be affected, as will the ability of mature families in downsizing their housing component. If we look at migration by year since 1990, and these are July to July estimates produced by the Census Bureau, the net international flow includes immigration plus movement of U.S. nationals overseas and from overseas. So, for example, large corporations that send somebody out to work in Europe for a couple of years, that would be an outflow, and then when they return, that is an in-migration, even though that's not immigration, it is an inflow, and that's included in the international migration. Domestic migration includes any movement from one state, from another state to or from Minnesota. The movement of during the 90s, we saw not only international migration, but substantial inflows of people, averaging close to 10,000 people per year, a net inflow of people from other states as the number of people migrating into Minnesota increased and the number of people migrating out of Minnesota decreased. Since 2000, we have seen a continuation and actually a bit of an increase in international migration and a continued inflow of people from other countries, but that is countered by a net outflow of people to and from other states, with an increase in out-migration and an increase decrease in migration to and from other states. That has been diminishing over the last couple of years, and the current job market carrying this forward, the best guess would be that the current job market would slow down the rate of mobility overall and slow down the level of in-migration, the number of people moving to Minnesota, have probably less of an impact on people moving from Minnesota, which seems a bit less influenced by current job markets, and overall would have the impact of slowing population growth even further. As we move further and further into the longer run, we see dramatic changes over the next decade in the age structure of our population, with very large numbers of people in Minnesota and the United States reaching their 50s and 60s, with relatively fewer young people in society. We are aging rapidly as a society, but this is not occurring at a constant rate. The the difference between the number of people turning age 62 in 2008 versus those turning age 62 in 2007 is approximately a 30% differential in Minnesota and the United States. The leading edge of the baby boom generation that was born in 1946, when we saw a dramatic increase in the number of babies born, those people have aged at a steady pace, and they are now turning 62 starting this year. And the first wave of people applying for Social Security payments has already hit Social Security offices, and those numbers will continue to increase. Now, whether these people stay in the workforce longer and continue to work longer as a result of current economic conditions and a dramatic change in their wealth situation relative to the financial markets, we may see a delay in the retirement age, but they will still turn age 62, and then 3 years later they turn 65 and become increasingly eligible for Medicare and higher levels of Social Security payments, and their likelihood of retiring increases. That will happen at the same time that the number of young people 18 to 24 declines in both Minnesota and the United States. All of our neighboring states are already seeing a decline in the number of 18 to 24 year old population, and we are very close to that. The high school graduation class of this spring and next spring will be the largest that we will see for some years in the future. And increasingly, our workforce growth, and to some extent economic growth, because economic growth is dependent on the size of the workforce and also the level of productivity in the workforce, that the rate of growth in our workforce will be slowing down. Migration will become an increasingly important component to that, but as we see, that is a much less certain component, because it depends not only on what is happening everywhere else, it also depends on not only what's happening here, but it also depends on what's happening everywhere else. And our relative position in economic growth is strongly influenced by the rate of growth of strongly influences the rate of growth of the labor force.
Well, that brings us to kind of a summary set of points that we want to make here, and that is that there are really what we call three R's for economic success in the teens, looking out into the future. What Minnesota has to sell in terms of its ability to attract new economic activity in the state is a high-quality, productive workforce. And that's the thing that we have to be concerned about. How do we maintain, how do we keep it growing in there? And here there are three key factors that have to be considered. They have to be considered by private industry. They have to be considered by state, by the state and state government activity. But they also have to be considered by the state as it tries to encourage longer-term economic growth. And those three R's are retention. We have a large group of people that are going to be retiring or leaving the workforce, and we can replace those people, we can replace the body, but not the knowledge. Experience is valuable. If we want to build our productivity, we don't help ourselves by losing these well-experienced, knowledgeable people. So we need to be thinking about, are there ways of providing incentives for people to not just retire, but to continue on maybe in a part-time position or something like that for a little bit longer in the workforce. So that's one key. The second key for business, for the state, and for the state's economy is recruitment. As you saw from that earlier graph, the number of people 18 to 24, the number of people entering the workforce is going to decline both in Minnesota and nationally, but it's going to decline more rapidly in Minnesota than nationally. So the question is, how are we going to attract the people to the state that we need to fill those jobs that we're going to have? And then finally, there's this issue of retraining. One of the neglected facts people don't often think of is that 80% of the people, more than 80% of the people that are going to be working 10 years from now are already in the workforce. They're already working. You know, it's important to provide money for K-12. It's important to provide money for immediate post-secondary education. But we have to be concerned about what our ability is to provide retraining in an increasingly technological global marketplace for the people that are already in the workforce. And it becomes especially important because of the migration to the state. It used to be that when people migrated to the state, we were getting them from Iowa and the Dakotas, and we knew the quality of education that these people had. We've taken most of the available people that we can get from those states, and so the migration that's coming to the state is coming from other places, places that may not have the same standards for education as we had before. So those are the three concerns, the three R's for economic success. Now to the challenges. First, here's a graph of Minnesota's employment growth 2001 to 2007. It's a long period. And you can see from the graph that the U.S. Has grown faster, 4.2% over that period, than Minnesota has, 2.2%. The question is this cyclical, or is it structural, or is it a series of unrelated events combined with some cyclicality? And that's something that we need to pay more attention to. We need to start thinking about what we do for this to change this trend, if it is structural and not cyclical, if it is structural and not just due to some isolated events. One of the areas that we think is an area of concern and we should start thinking about is academic research. Academic research is a key factor in state economic growth. President Brunich of the university has a op-ed piece in the paper yesterday, I believe, talking about how important research is to Minnesota. Now, I'm biased because I'm university faculty, but all economists agree that research and development is the key to future productivity, and that's what we have to say. There was a report written by a colleague of mine, Phil Pardee, on research and development activity in the state. He has nice copies of it, and I'm sure you could get one if you wanted. I recommend it to you. But Phil notes the following things. One, lags between research and development and outcomes take a long time, years, maybe even decades. And what that means is that the state may be able to do well for a while by drawing down its existing stock of knowledge capital. But how the state will fare in the future will crucially depend upon its investment in research and development. So now the question is, how have we done? And here are the facts. In terms of total academic R&D spending, we rank slightly worse than we did in 1972. The numbers are for 2004. We rank 26th among states as opposed to 19th. But if you look at academic R&D spending per capita or academic R&D spending per dollar of gross state product, you see that we've fallen, and we've fallen pretty dramatically. That's something that, again, you wouldn't be a problem for this year's economy or next year's economy necessarily, but over a period of 20 years it begins to deteriorate and cause you to lose a little bit of your competitive advantage. Here's Tom to tell you about an even more, concern.
If we go think about the concept of first principles. Why is Minnesota a prosperous place? Why do we rank so highly across many variables? And one thing that is on the top of many people's lists and certainly has been a major factor, if not the largest factor, was that we created a very high quality, well educated, highly productive workforce that was in large part created because we made a major push forward in education. Minnesota now leads the nation in the proportion of our adult population age 25 and older with at least a high school diploma. We rank number one in the nation, and the United States leads the OECD countries in the proportion of the OECD countries that are the economically developed, richer nations of the world, and the United States leads the OECD countries in the proportion of our adults with at least a high school diploma. So Minnesota there is highly world competitive. But if we look at the current high school graduation rates, and there are different ways of measuring this. This is one way of measuring, and there are other ways that give slightly different percentages, but some a bit higher, some a bit lower. But they all lead to the same conclusion, is that there are large differences by groups within Minnesota. The Hispanic or Latino children and Black or African American children graduate from high school at a much, much lower rate than the majority white students. But one element of this is that the majority white students may not even be graduating at the same rate that the current adult population has graduated in Minnesota. Now, this isn't just a Minnesota trend. This is also a national trend that while the nation leads OECD countries in current graduations in the proportion of our adults with a high school diploma, the United States has one of the lowest records of current graduates among all OECD countries, substantially less than our historical level. So the United States is actually moving backwards by international comparison. There are many other ways of looking at this. We can look at standardized test scores and many other factors and ways of measuring this, but they all point to the same direction, is that the United States and Minnesota specifically are not investing to the same or achieving the same level of success in education that we have in the past, at the very time when productivity is going to become an even more important factor and higher levels of education will become increasingly important to future economic growth. Let me stop there.
Madam Chair, that concludes our prepared remarks. We'd be glad to answer questions, or if you want to wait and hear Mr. Anton's remarks and then ask questions of the three of us, we could do it that way, too.
Well, why don't we see if there are any questions that people would like directed right now, realizing that there'll be another chance after we listen to Mr. Anton. Representative Winslow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to clarify, so your point basically here is that because of, and I'm guessing it has to do with a lot of other nations have increased dramatically their high school graduation rate, and they are catching up with us or eventually will surpass us in the proportion of their adults with high school degrees, because our rate has either declined or at least has relatively declined to them, and so that over time the proportion of our population with high school degrees is going to be lower than theirs if the trend continues.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, that is certainly a major part of the point, but another aspect of the point is that the populations that are growing in our schools, the populations that are increasing in number, are the ones with the very lowest rates of high school graduation, and overall enrollments are declining slowly. But the Hispanic or Latino students and Black or African American students are increasing as a relative proportion, and they are increasing in absolute numbers.
So in a sense, you're saying the growing part of the population is where the big disparity is, so the rate actually is likely to get worse unless we do something different.
Madam Chair, Representative Winfrey, yes.
So the final point then would be this achievement gap that people talk about, the high school graduation rate, is an economic competitiveness issue, because it means that a smaller percentage of our population over time is going to have a high school degree, which is a great determiner of economic productivity.
Yeah. And Chair Representative Winkler, yes, that was a good conclusion.
Okay. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. The high school graduation rate, we are the highest. I think, as I recall from a NCSL deal that Representative McFarland and I went to as Representative Lye, I think we got 86% of our high school seniors graduate. Is that correct, as you recall it? And out of those, 54% go on to further education. And out of that, 26 or 27% graduate with a degree. It seems to me that our problem isn't with the number of high school graduates or the number of those graduates that go on to further education. It's the graduation rate that we really are far behind compared to the rest of the world. Is there any way that your research indicated how we can improve that so we can catch up with the rest of the world and having a graduation rate that is closer to the rate of students that go enter in post-secondary education?
Well, if I can just put a little addition on to that, don't we, you know, I know, in looking at a friend who has a kid in a child just graduating high school in Switzerland has already been told that he can't, I'm sorry, elementary, middle school, been told that he can't go into an academic high school, and, you know, counted it by sending him to a private one. Don't we send very, very much more higher percentage of our population compared to European countries and certainly Asian countries on for higher education? Isn't that a part of it?
Madam Chair, Representative Gunther, the United States and Minnesota have historically sent a much higher proportion onto higher education. I think the question in my mind is, will that continue? Representative Gunther quoted an 85 or 86% high school graduation rate, which leads the nation, or is one of the top in the nation, depending on how you measure it, as one of the highest levels. But the proportion of our adult population age 25 and older with a high school diploma is 91%, which is higher than the current level of graduation. So the concern is at the very time when we may need more higher levels of educational achievement, we may not even be matching our historic level.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Certainly before they can attain higher levels of education, they got to get through the first ones first, and that's where we're failing.
Okay. Representative
Lafarge. Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Gillespie, the graduation rates are no doubt important, but another question I had for you that is related and more important, at least to my mind, is say you take your typical, if there is such a thing, high school graduate in Minnesota. Where does that young man or woman stand in comparison to their peers in competing jurisdictions, whether that's, I don't know, California, for example, here within the United States, or other industrialized nations like Japan or Sweden or Belgium? I mean, are we up there in terms of math and science scores with our peers in other developed nations? What sort of the historical trend? Are we falling behind? Are we ahead? I was wondering if you had any information with respect to that aspect of scores and graduation standards.
Madam Chair, Representative LaForest, there are standardized tests that are done nationally. There are also standardized tests that are done internationally. I don't have a state level reading for how we compare internationally. The United States has been generally eroded some in its standing in terms of test scores. Minnesota tends to test very well. The concern I have, and I believe the concern that Mr. Simpson has, is going forward into the future. Are we achieving at the same level, and are we achieving at a level that is necessary for us to retain this reputation of an internationally renowned workforce that is highly productive? Are we able to retain that and to move forward and attract the highest quality of employers and the highest level of wages and benefits? And that is concern as to how we're, which direction we're moving.
Okay, let's go on to the next person, and I'm sure we'll go back to a panel with all three interacting with each other and answering questions. Okay? Mr. Anton, please identify who you are for the patient.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Paul Anton. I'm the chief economist for Wilder Research, which is a part of the Wilder Foundation in St. Paul. The Wilder Foundation itself does not take positions on any kind of legislation, but allows or encourages its research people to share their expertise and provide opinions that can affect the legislation. So I'm here speaking as an economist, and also I guess as a member of the State's Council of Economic Advisors since its inception, and I believe 1985, though my memory is not what it was when I was younger, so I might be off by a year or two. When I was asked to speak, I was given the topic of, well, what's going on with the Minnesota economy and what should we do about it? But as I saw the title of this session listed as, is Minnesota regaining or keeping its competitive advantage, I'll address myself a bit to that question. The preparation I made before I saw that seems to me on point with the kinds of decisions you'll be thinking about in this session anyway. First, in terms of the economic situation and how it's reflected in Minnesota, we may or may not be in a recession, but that doesn't really change the actions that you'll be facing, since the economy is definitely growing slowly, more slowly both nationally and in Minnesota, and that's reflected in the employment statistics that you've already seen quoted. We don't have gross domestic product for the state on a quarter-by-quarter basis, which is probably a good thing for us all, but nevertheless, the measurable consequences of a slower economy are obvious right now. As such, you'll be asked to make changes in the budget to react to the fact that revenue growth will be slower than we had hoped as a result. It's also the case that certain kinds of social spending that are tied to the business cycle may in fact be somewhat higher, which will put additional pressure on you. I should mention that as you think about the three ways to react to that budget situation, and I think the three ways that I'm aware of are tax increases, spending cuts, or shifts. There is, in technical economics terminology, a differential impact of those three actions on the amount of economic activity in the state. I would argue that shifts are the ones that have the least short-term impact because they may not actually even change the amount of spending happening for the short term. Between tax increases and spending cuts, this sounds like a political statement. It's not, but technically speaking, in most cases, tax increases have less of a reduction in economic activity than do spending cuts. The reason being that when the government stops and doesn't spend a dollar, that entire dollar comes out of the stream of spending. If there's a tax increase, some of that money would have been money that would have been saved in general by corporations or individuals, and so that creates a differential. Now, it is true if we drill down another level, if the spending is, let's say, to hire a consultant or, heaven forbid, an economist from Massachusetts or somewhere to give advice, then that has a differential impact. But just in terms of a first level of analysis, that's what most economists would argue. But the short-term impact on an economic activity measured in activity in some way or employment should not be the guide for how you decide on the kinds of budget actions that you'll be need to be taking in response to the economic situation. Instead, I would argue you need to focus on the long-term and structural issues about the state's economy. For a couple of reasons. One is because those are really the only ones you can have very substantive impact on. And second of all, because it is the national government's role to try to deal with the business cycle. I think if Ben Bernanke were here today, he would argue that the Federal Reserve's role is not to try to avoid recession. And in fact, most economists would say that they're a normal part of life that we have to deal with, and that the role of even the federal government, whether it's Federal Reserve or the fiscal policy from the national government, is to try to smooth out the business cycle, somewhat mitigate the effects of the of recessions on certain populations, rather than to try to eliminate them completely, which would be a task we now think is beyond our abilities to do if we were going to try it. In the 60s, we felt a little differently about that than we do now. Nevertheless, I'd like to turn my attention to the question then that's at the head of today's hearing, which is Minnesota losing its competitive edge or retaining it? I forget which way the question was posed. In any case, such a question leads one to think in kind of black and white terms, like, are we competitive or aren't we? But I would argue that, of course, the actual situation is that we're on a continuum of competitiveness, both across different industries and in some absolute sense. And therefore, and it's also the case, unfortunately, that changes in our competitive position can only be known with a lag. We don't know right now if the employment statistics that Tom Stinson was showing you are the leading edge of something that will persist for the next several years, or something that will go away because of the business cycle. I do know that there's no obvious single thing we can point to that's the reason why we should be underperforming the national economy with regard to employment or with regard to the unemployment statistics that give us the easy answer we can all agree on. Therefore, in thinking about the competitive advantage of the state, we are stuck with the fact that we won't really have definitive knowledge about how things are going until well after a trend has been established, and therefore well after the time when we will have wished we would have acted. In particular, the key advantage that Tom cites that I agree with is that we have a very educated and skilled workforce in Minnesota, and there's an especially long recognition lag in finding out that your workforce is not as competitive as it once was, and if you realize that, there's also a fairly long time lag from action to when your efforts bear fruit. There's a lot of talk about early childhood education right now, which I agree is an important thing to think about. But obviously, 4- and 5-year-olds are not going to be stepping onto assembly lines or into offices for another 18 years, for example. So investment in that is not something that shows up in tomorrow's state GDP or employment numbers, even if we do it. The fact that this is one of the committees meeting here is the Higher Education Committee, and I have done some research that bears on this question, looking at trying to estimate the return on investment to spending on higher education in the Minsky system. And to do that, we did some very approximate things that looked at what is the actual training of people generated by that system, how much of that training might not have been accomplished without the system, and how does that work through the state's economy in terms of the value of that labor is reflected in the wages those people earn, with the assumption that the wages that the people earn is in proportion to the output that's generated. And our estimates, rough though they are that there's about a $6 return to the state of Minnesota on an annual basis for the dollar, $6 return for the dollars of annual spending in a system like that. Now that's economists put decimal points on a lot of their calculations as an attempt at humor, whether it's $6.40 or $5.75, I would say are both within the realm. But the point is that there is a substantial return that is important for us to pay attention to, I think. Now, in terms of the key advantage of our skilled workforce, I guess what I would say is that actions which help to enhance the value of that workforce are not lost. regardless of exactly where our competitive position is, whether it's that they add to our strength, reinforce our strength, or compensate for changes that are happening. And therefore, not having an exact snapshot of what's going on doesn't change, in my mind, the urgency of continuing to invest in that area. Facts that contribute to my concern that our competitive advantage is being somewhat eroded are part of the things that have been quoted here. The persistently slower payroll growth of the last 3 years, and especially of the last 2 years in Minnesota, is key among those. And as I said, there's no obvious, easy explanation of some cyclical fact that we can count on turning around. A second thing that was alluded to in the previous slide is the number of workers reaching retirement age, reaching an age when they could retire, and the turnover that will take place in our labor force inexorably, whether or not people choose to retire at 62 or 65. Eventually, they will leave the workforce. If you were to project out what the workforce of 2020 or 2030 will look like in Minnesota, it will have a different demographic makeup than the one than today, as is as I guess specific statistics were presented on that. But I think you're probably all aware of this. I think the single largest growth factor will be the growth in Hispanic workers, and you see that in our school age population today. So there are two trends that will affect the workforce of the future that I want to mention. And first is that shift towards a greater minority population and a population that is growing up in large part in on average lower income households. That interacts with a second trend, which is the growing cost of higher education in Minnesota and the tuition increases that have taken place in past years. The interaction of these two trends does mean that more of the school-age children in our K-12 system now will have a harder time, their families and they will, affording tuition in the future and going on to higher education in numbers that we would hope would increase relative to now, but just to maintain the flow through of trained people through higher education is a challenge given the demographic trends and the cost trend in education that we have. Immigration can help our workforce at the margin, but most of the workforce will continue to be homegrown in the future as it is now. Therefore, actions to support education at all levels contribute and are interrelated to the chain of generating more workers for our businesses and for our economy. Some mention was made of high school graduation rates by Representative Gunther and by Tom Gillespie. I recommend to you a study recently done by funded by the Gates Foundation and done by John DiIulio and I forget his co-author on high school dropouts, which shows that a surprisingly high proportion of high school dropouts are not failing at the time they drop out. They have C averages, but are not that interested in continuing, meaning that it's not strictly that the people who are not dropping out are people who do not have the skills or who, if motivated in some way, could not succeed, which is part of a stereotype that I think it's easy to carry. So within the purview of this committee, or at least of the higher education portion of this committee, I would encourage you to think about actions which enhance the affordability of higher education for the students who are going to be graduating from high school or who should be graduating from high school. And I didn't have it in my first notes, but I re-echo the point that Tom Stinson made that retraining of our adult working population will be increasingly important. I didn't come armed with statistics on that point, but the number of people who have to retrain for new jobs in not once but several times in their lifetime has been a dramatic and established fact of labor markets for some years now, and I don't think you need to have statistics for to make you believe that that's an important thing. I would also mention I am part of a team at Wilder Research that is doing an evaluation of the Centers of Excellence program that was started a couple of years ago at some of the Minsky campuses. And I would not be, I'm not supposed to let anything out of the bag, but what I would tell you is that surveys of Minnesota businesses make it very clear that the key return they are looking for from these centers of excellence is more highly trained workers with specific skills, and also with a general high level of education that makes those workers adaptable to the changes in their workplaces. A second thing that businesses mention, and not as strongly but still mention, and that we see in the context of the Centers of Excellence, is the need for applied research. That's part of the design of those centers. Tom Stinson mentioned that academic research at our higher education institutions is not where it was 30 years ago, and I think we're bearing our current prosperity is part of that investment too. In any case, I would mention one last thing, which is that in particular, if we think about the kinds of education that generate increases in productivity in the workforce, that generate productive companies and enterprises in Minnesota, of special concern to me is how we look in terms of the people getting training in science, technology, engineering, mathematics, the STEM fields. A number of years ago, I started going back to the economic seminars at the Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis, where I once worked, and the highly academic seminars. When I was waiting, I talked to three graduate students who were also going. They were from Switzerland, Germany, and Japan, and it turns out that at the time I worked at the Federal Reserve, we had like seven research assistants there, all of us U.S. born. Now there are research assistants and grad students working there, 21 of them. One of them is U.S. born and the other 20 are foreign born. This pattern, I think, to some extent, is also evident in various other technical education, and it's something that concerns me and that I hope we can find a way to interest U.S. Students, including my 14-year-old son, who gets A+ in science but wants to go in the film industry. So it's cultural and outside of the purview of this committee to do everything about. But in any case, I think that's something worth considering. With that, I'll end my remarks, and I'd be glad to take questions. I think it'd be useful to invite the two Toms up as well for more questions.
If I can just interject one, is it necessarily bad that we have all these people that have been educated? Isn't it cheaper to import someone who has their education somewhere else than to grow them here and educate them here?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I see the internal logic of what you're saying, and it is true that if we could bring highly educated people to Minnesota in large numbers, that would help. For one thing, the visa situation and the limits on B1 visas are such that there's a limit on the number of people that we can bring in. Second of all, many of those people are educated at our institutions too. That would be a help to the state's economy, but we would find ourselves in competition with the other states as well. And the numbers of people we can bring in relative to the numbers of people that are homegrown are such that we still cannot look to that as a complete solution, in my view.
Madam Chair, to that point, we imported you, and the Republicans are arguing it's been costing us money ever since.
Well, let me use myself as a perfect case. I was educated, had a lot of education at great expense to a lot of people, not me, mainly the federal government, in fact. Came here, of course, as a card-carrying member of a nuclear family because my husband was offered a job at the university, and
might have stayed at the university forever if it hadn't have been for their sexist discriminatory attitudes, which got me to run for the legislature. So I don't know what kind of a case we want to use for that and what's changed, but anyway. I think we have two more people to speak, maybe, and then maybe we'll do the panel with all five instead of, if that's okay. Can people still stay? Yeah. Is going to do this?
Madam Chairman, as long as we're going to do that, I do have a couple questions.
Okay.
Dr. Anton, I really respect the research the Wild Institute does. I think they do a lot of very good creative things for the state of Minnesota. I've followed a lot of it, and I appreciate it very much. They say in the next 6 years now, it was seven last year, that we're going to be missing 10% of our traditional Minnesota students in higher education because of declining enrollment and other reasons. And with a big drain like that on the potential of getting good trained workforce, what do you suggest we do? And has there been any research done? What is the best way of getting that good trained workforce back in Minnesota at 100% instead of 90%? Do we go after the students in Michigan and have them come here knowing Minsky says we 85% of those that graduate from the Minsky institution stay in Minnesota and work? How do we go about getting that terrible statistic that we're going to be really suffering from in later years corrected?
Madam Chairman, Representative Gunther, that 10% decline in high school graduates, I think is what you're talking about, is something that Michigan and the other states are having as well. And therefore, it probably would be a very expensive thing to try to pull population from other states. The way in which the labor market equilibrates is if you have fewer workers, then the price of them, the wage of them goes up, and the wage can be justified if there's higher productivity per worker, per person. If you think about an example what it means is that you will have think of a factory that has more sophisticated equipment where one person pushes buttons rather than people do handwork. You can see that you can produce more output. The one person pushing those buttons gets paid a higher wage than the people doing the handwork. So an awful lot of the adjustment across our economy as a whole will have to be in terms of higher productivity, rather than that we could replace those lost numbers of high school students. That being said, in terms of producing effective workers in the workforce, I would argue that the actions we should look to are to try to maintain or raise the percentage of our students who complete high school and graduate, and also think about ways of making it easier for them to get further training so they can be those higher productivity workers. But I don't think it would be a solution to do a big recruitment program from other states under the assumption that they're going to be asleep and not be trying to work on this themselves. That's not what an economist would call a general equilibrium solution to the problem.
Some people have said that a little recruitment program might be just to get rid of the whole, for higher education at least, might be to get rid of the concept of out-of-state tuition and just have one level of tuition that we talked about. Now, I don't know the exact numbers on that, but one of the things I was surprised was that it isn't that much. The tuition differential doesn't bring us that much money.
Madam Chairman, as an economist, I would say that yes, that would have an impact at the margin of bringing more students into higher education in the state than are now, and unless and until there were reciprocal actions taken by other by other states, I suppose. But yes, that would be something that could have an impact. I don't know how large the impact would be.
Yes, Representative Hall.
I would like to echo that, Madam Chair. You know, if you're saying that we don't have enough of the students going into our universities, but yet then we're supposed to be recruiting, but then the first thing is that we're going to charge them a higher rate to come here, there seems to be some counterproductive logic to that. So I think it's something that should be looked at least for certain majors.
Representative Paulson?
Madam Chair, I was just going to mention that a number of years ago we had the Elmer Anderson, former Governor Anderson Commission, and that was one of the centerpieces of their recommendations for higher education, was not to charge out-of-state tuition and then draw students into Minnesota as a result of that, and something that, for whatever reason, just never happened.
We're here. Why don't we make it? Okay. We're here.
Madam Chairman, you write the bill. I'll co-author it. I also look at, you mentioned research. I think when we look at all the initiatives in the state of Minnesota to make things more efficient and cost-effective, I think maybe one of the things we should consider is sharing research with other research institutes such as the University of Wisconsin, Iowa, Illinois, and so forth. If they do the same research, why do we have to reinvent that? Why can't we share their research with them and have them share our research with them also? That way, we might make that research even stronger. So I just think that's not only efficiency, but makes sense. What is your opinion on that?
Madam Chairman, Representative Gunther, I'm not sure that there would be a lot of return to that. The reason is that I believe that that the results of scientific research are pretty broadly shared among the scientific community, and the collaboration that happens between people even now, I would bet that some co-authored papers by researchers at the University of Minnesota, I know, would have co-authors at the University of Wisconsin, or maybe at the University at MIT, or the University of Toronto, or maybe even Milan. And so I think that the idea that the research, that there's, you know, parallel redundant research being done by several people doing exactly the same thing in a bunch of different places I think there's not as much economy in that as you may think there is, and then sometimes that research is done anyway to verify and validate the results. So I'm not sure that we would get more for our research dollar in general by doing that, but that's not to say that we couldn't take some sort of multi-state initiative in a certain area that would make sense for us to ramp up what's happening in this region and share resources if there were, let's say, there were some sort of very expensive to build type of technical facility that we couldn't talk to Wisconsin about. Let's build it on the border, or let's build it somewhere and use it ourselves. But as a general principle of, I don't think the I don't think there would be huge returns to that across the board.
Okay. Let's bring up the next two people, and then we'll bring up everyone to continue this conversation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Angel.
Next person is Sue Moreau, a St. Paul resident, former small business owner and company executive. She's going to tell what her experience is. Ms. Moreau.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. I was asked to come today and talk about my experience. I'm currently looking for a job in the state of Minnesota. My background is I came out of the University of Minnesota with a business degree, got a job with a local manufacturing company, worked there for 17 years, was the director of customer service at the time that I left. It was a position that I voluntarily resigned because I had two daughters that I wanted to spend some time with, and my job did not give me a lot of flexibility. So I left that position in 1999 and subsequently took a position with a large multinational. Stayed there a short period of time and was offered an opportunity to do some contract work for Startup.com. This was in, you know, late, I guess it was early 2000s, so there were a lot of Startup.coms. Very lucrative, very fun thing to do, but as most dot-coms, it went by the wayside. And so I suddenly found myself unemployed in the beginning of 2000, and the job market in Minnesota was not very good at that time. Started looking for a job, again, trying to maintain some flexibility so that I could have time with my daughters, and found that the best solution for me was to start my own business so that I could have the goals, my career goals and my personal goals. Ran that business for 4 years, and what I actually did was I bought into a franchise, and it was a franchise that helped people who wanted to purchase franchises. So I worked with a lot of people who happened to be in job transition. Oftentimes the reason people came to me was because they had suddenly found themselves out of a job. A lot of people, baby boomers who had built up equity in their homes, they had assets they could consider buying a business. Ultimately decided to get out of that business and get back into the job market for a lot of different reasons, but what I'm finding is that my experience is no different from any of these people that I've worked with over the years. You know, and somehow I thought I was above all of that. I was educated. I had computer skills. One of the things a lot of people might run into is they don't have the computer skills. They don't even know how to go out and look for a job. They don't know how to fill out an online application. They don't have their Word and Excel and whatnot skills. So when they're asked for that as a critical factor in almost any position today, they can't come up with that. But what you find when you're out looking for a job is, first of all, employers are looking for very specific requirements. I mean, they will have a litany of very detailed background or experience skills that they are looking for you to have. Also, what you're going to find is that you have to go out and get those on your own. Employers no longer train the employee to become their employee of the future. It's much more of a tin can situation. They'll use you up and throw you away. And that's really, that sounds like a victim, and I don't like to come across as a victim because I don't think anybody has to be a victim, but I think that many workers feel like victims in today's society. They put in their time, they do a very good job for the organization, and then the organization has a change, and they just throw people out the door and bring in a whole new crew that have the skills they're wanting. I think that's a huge factor for people looking for jobs, and I think that anything that the government can do to facilitate people getting the kind of training that they need to move on to the next position and become a valuable employee for the employer would be very beneficial. I can tell you that there is a recession. Part of what I did when I had my own business was I went to a lot of job transition groups because that was one place that I could meet people. I have seen the ebb and flow of numbers in these groups, and right now the numbers are increasing. Also, what you'll find in these groups is there's a lot of people that aren't going to show up on your unemployment numbers because they've exceeded that 6 month limit, and so they're, you know, maybe working temp jobs or doing whatever they can, you know, working at Menards, I don't know, doing whatever they can to hang on, trying to hang on to their home, trying to not have it foreclose on them. But they're not showing up on your numbers anymore, even though the unemployment numbers in Minnesota are going up. I think, too, you know, as a job seeker, I feel a real sense of urgency because I don't see the economy getting better. I see it getting worse, and I feel like if I don't get into something pretty quickly, my odds are just getting worse every day. And also, at the same time, I have to look at what are the kinds of opportunities that I'll consider because I don't want to consider something that's highly risky. Even when you make a good choice and get into a solid position, it's probably only going to last maybe 3 years. So you don't want to take that risk that you're going to get into something that, you know, 6 months later you're in the exact same position and starting over, because the fact of the matter is it takes a long time to find a position. You know, I believe what I've read is about 1 month for every 10,000 that you're looking to earn for income. You know, so I think as a group, of your, like yourself, look at these problems. The things that I would ask you to look at is how do you provide training to existing workers? I mean, obviously people coming into the workforce, that's important. I have an 18 and a 19-year-old, so I'm looking at colleges, or I'm paying for college at this point in time, and I'm hoping that my daughters have jobs when they get out into the workforce. But anything you can do to provide training for people who are in transition, who don't have the skills they need, anything that you can do to maybe extend benefits to people who end up in a very long unemployment situation. The problem is people run out of either their unemployment benefits or their personal savings, and then they just, you know, it turns into a tragedy for the family. And helping people, and I think you do a very good job at the workforce centers, but helping people learn how to look for a job. You know, many people have never had to go out and network. They've never had to go out and meet people that they don't know. They've never had to go and tell their story, and they don't know how to go about negotiating getting a job. So teaching them those skills that they need. I think we have a lot of talented people in Minnesota. If you look at demographics, obviously we have a lot of educated people. Because of economic conditions, they're probably not going to be retiring at 62. They're going to have to extend their work period. And so, you know, another thing, anything that you can do to help the employer see the value of that demographic, so that they're not always looking for the person who's in their 20s or 30s. Because, you know, another thing is if you're over 40, they're likely to discriminate against you. So I guess that's my story and my input on the situation. I'd be happy to answer any questions anyone would have.
Okay. If you stay around, we may have questions for you in the panel. Thank you so much for helping to put a human individual face on what we're talking about. Okay. The next person is Timothy Mulcahy, the Vice President for Research at the University of Minnesota. Mr. Mulcahy.
Madam Chairman, distinguished members of the committee, my name is Tim Mulcahy, and I am the Vice President for Research at the University of Minnesota, a position I've been proud to hold for the past 3 years, and it is indeed my pleasure to be here with you to share some of my personal perspectives on how to consider the role and the contributions of a university like the University of Minnesota to the question of Minnesota's economic future. And I have circulated for your assistance a handout which will just outline my comments this morning. I apologize to those of you in the audience for not having anticipated enough copies, but anyone who would be interested, if they emailed me directly, I'd be happy to send them to you. I think my comments will be sufficiently self-evident and easy enough to follow that I don't think you actually need a visual to assist, but if you want it for a record, I can be happy to provide it. First of all, let me just state that, as has been acknowledged in many fora, including this one this morning, the university's impact across the state of Minnesota is very wide and very deep. And I've just quickly summarized what is known to this esteemed body already, but, you know, there are 5 campuses of the University of Minnesota across the state, 18 regional extension offices which touch virtually every aspect of everyday life of the state of Minnesota, 13 research and outreach centers, and we have in excess of 65,000 students enrolled at the university, nearly 20,000 graduate and professional students. So the potential for an impact is very large, and I think the university has fulfilled a very important role in Minnesota's future, past and future. Let me just make a personal comment. The next slide is discussing economic assets. Many times when I've been asked to speak before a body like this, what the audience anticipates is a discussion of the university's commercialization of its intellectual property. How many startup companies have you generated? And I will acknowledge that that is a very important contribution and component of the university's role in the economic engine in Minnesota. However, I think it grossly undersells the other aspects, the other threads to the economy that are vital and that the university plays a very significant role. So when I talk about economic assets and economic contributions, I like to refer to not the university's intellectual property, but really the university's intellectual capital. Because as we've talked to corporate leaders and employers across the state, what we hear from them is they're more interested in other assets in the university, as well as our intellectual property and our commercialization efforts. So I want to summarize what I consider important components of the university's contribution to the economy of the state. And that is clearly education. And we've heard this morning eloquent discussions about the importance of a highly educated workforce to the economic future of any state. And certainly at this state, there is cause for concern in this quarter. Our alumni, students who've been at the university at some point in their life, turn out to be extremely important lifelong contributors. And I'm going to summarize some of those contributions for you. Clearly, our faculty are the innovators. They serve as consultants and collaborators. They are the spark of discovery and innovation that's critical to an economy. And I can tell you that recent studies have suggested that one of the most important things in a region, if in fact the university is to contribute in a meaningful way to the long-term economic future of the state in which they're located, is having the best faculty available. That is probably the single most important factor in the equation of success for a university as an economic engine. Our facilities are extremely important. We have very elaborate, unique equipment and expertise represented at the university that is regularly accessed by corporations and individuals across the state and actually constitutes an important part of their individual business plans and their future. Clearly, research, discovery, and innovation is what we really focus on as our one of our prime factors, and I'll summarize some of the economic impacts there. And then finally, as I mentioned, commercialization potential of our intellectual property is clearly a very important element. And states across the nation are turning to their premier research universities with increasing frequency, expecting that we are indeed going to be the economic engine that drives the state's economy to higher heights in the future. And I think the expectation is the same here in Minnesota. And on behalf of the university, I'm happy to say we feel we stand up to the challenge and are ready to work with you to make that future possible. We did a study across the state early in my tenure here. We contacted 30 CEOs of medium, small, and large companies across Minnesota. We did 15 in the Twin Cities area, 15 from greater Minnesota, and we specifically asked them, what is it that you value most or hope to get most from the university in terms of benefits to your company, to your region? And the diagram that I show you here lists in order of importance to those respondents what they viewed as important to them. One is the undergraduate students as a key part of their workforce. Then comes graduate students, and one of the things we've heard today about the importance of retraining the workforce, they expect and look for continuing education opportunities. They look for resources and collaborative efforts through our research centers. They look to university faculty for consulting on all sorts of aspects of their business plan, whether that's research or policy. They look to sponsor research at the university, and at the very bottom of this pyramid of hierarchy was purchasing intellectual property from the university or commercialization. So although it's part of the array that they look for, it is not the most important, and I think this just reaffirms my comment earlier that we really need to be focusing on how the university contributes to its intellectual capital and not focusing exclusively on its intellectual property. Now, let me briefly comment on each of these various categories. First of all, students are our most sought-after resource. It goes without saying. We graduate 13,000 students each year. 29% of all bachelor or higher degrees awarded in the state of Minnesota are awarded at the University of Minnesota. 40% of all STEM degrees and virtually all engineering majors come out of the University of Minnesota. Over 70% of our healthcare providers are trained at the Academic Health Center and other components of the University of Minnesota. And in fact, the university serves as an important talent magnet to attract non-resident graduates And our survey indicates that between 30% and 40% of non-resident graduates from the University of Minnesota remain in Minnesota after graduation. So it's a very important talent magnet, and the contribution of those individuals contributes significantly to the state's economy in many ways. Sometimes a forgotten element of an economic impact is what have people who've trained at the university contributed over the course of their lifetime. And the next slide here is just a report of a summary that some of you may have seen that was conducted by the Alumni Association. And what it really depicts is that the impact and presence of the University of Minnesota and its graduates are felt throughout Minnesota. I'll highlight for those of you who don't have the benefit of the written material some of the key findings. Graduates of the University of Minnesota have been responsible for forming 10,000 companies in the state of Minnesota. 58% of the companies founded by university graduates have been in the state of Minnesota. They contribute another 9,000 across the nation, and on average, these companies employ 60 to 70 individuals. Those companies in the state of Minnesota employ over 500,000 people and another 600,000 nationally. They generate $1 billion in annual revenue in the state of Minnesota and another $130 billion nationally. And coming back to the talent magnet theme, 872 of those respondents who said they had founded companies since leaving the university, or 20% of the respondents, actually had moved to Minnesota as students from out of state and stayed in Minnesota after their education to found those companies. There can be no argument that this represents an extremely important contribution to the economy of the state. Another very important aspect, as I mentioned before, is the availability of expertise and unique facilities that are essential to driving our companies, established companies and new companies, to new heights in their own field of business. One example that I just cite here is an organization, a consortium of university and industry colleagues, iPrime is its name. It represents 45 faculty in 6 departments in our Institute of Technology. It really focuses on two-way knowledge transfer that's beneficial to our students, our faculty, and the corporate researchers involved. And it's an important source of pride for the university that this particular center is funded to the tune of $3 million a year from federal sources, encouraging collaboration between the university and business and industry in the region. And I would contend that is also a very important component of economic impact, one for which it's hard to translate specifically to a quantified number, but all you have to do is really think of what that means to the companies in the state, and I think you can imagine the impact. One of the big things that I think is important about the University of Minnesota is that our mission includes as one of its major components a strong emphasis on research. And clearly research is recognized as an important driver of the economy, an important driver of employment, and my esteemed colleagues who commented already this morning on the importance of research, I think, reaffirm that. I would like to try to summarize for you, and I apologize to the economists in the room because many times economists that I've spoken to about these kind of assessments cringe as to the suggestion that we can actually come up with a factor to calculate or convert the volume of research to a dollar economic impact. But I'm going to rely on the U.S. Department of Commerce, which is actually the agency that has suggested the translation factor that I'll use here. And that is, the U.S. Department of Commerce has suggested that 32 jobs in a region are created for every $1 million of research conducted by the university in that region. If you accept that correction factor, and I can tell you I've seen everything ranging from 32 to 38, so I adopted the most conservative numbers that I was aware of. If you did that and applied that to the $619 million in R&D that was conducted at the university in 2007, that accounts for, through ripple effects, approximately 20,000 jobs directly attributable to some aspect of the research enterprise at the university. Now, everyone in this room is very well aware of the strong and important impact that the university has had on the economic presence of Minnesota because of the great things we did in the past. And I've highlighted here the major food innovations in the university that have contributed to the great food industry in the state of Minnesota. The great work in the past on taconite and what that has done for the Iron Range. The discoveries in transplantation and medical device, which has made Minnesota the envy of the medical device world. Those are all tremendous contributions that I think we all can appreciate in the past. The question is, can the university continue to do that going forward? And my point here is that we are looking at today equally impressive and potentially even larger impact futures in several areas. And I've highlighted just five for you that we are working on now as major licensing opportunities or startup company opportunities. We are working on early diagnostic device for neurological disease, which will have a profound impact not just on the treatment of medicine, but on the prevention of disease and health care costs in general. We have great research in the area of bioenergy and biomass. Many of you are aware of Doris Taylor's great work, which was featured nationally about a week or two ago, about the ability of making tissue scaffolds, which will be critical for generating replacement tissues for heart, kidney, liver, and other types of transplantation phenomenon. We have robots that have been used to clear landmines and to do other hazardous duty that originated here at the university. And we're on the verge of breakthrough treatment and for the cure of diabetes. So continued investment in the research now will indeed have a future impact on the state. And I would reiterate what my colleagues have already mentioned is there is a long lag time. So we cannot afford to discontinue support of this research living on the success of our past. We have to continue to invest in the future in order to have a continuous impact on the economy moving forward. Finally, let me just mention a couple of things about commercialization of technology, because that is what most people think of when they think of economic impact. The University of Minnesota's technology pipeline has been ranked in the last couple of years fourth best in the nation, so we have great potential in our intellectual property and the technologies that are originating with our faculty. We were ranked sixth nationally in terms of technology commercialization in 2006. We earned $63.5 million in royalties, which were reinvested back into student support, research, and facilities at the university. In the last year, we launched three startups based on university technologies, and we're currently in discussion and evaluation for several other very promising startup opportunities. And these latter few examples of success actually are attributable to a significant overhaul in our technology transfer operation that we have implemented over the course of the last 2 years. Finally, I'd like to mention one other thing, because a question I've often heard is, well, you know, research is great and it's important, but don't we benefit from the benefits of research that are done in Michigan or Wisconsin? Why do we have to do it ourselves? Much of that, I think, I would answer by saying, look at what has happened in terms of the industry base in Minnesota, because the research was done here in the past. But another facet that I'd like to highlight to you is that many companies are attracted to Minnesota now because of the proximity and availability of the University of Minnesota and the resources there. I'm just going to highlight three examples from the past year. Victory Systems is a Virginia-based robotics company that builds drone helicopters and aircraft. They had a great need for finding wind tunnels in which to analyze and conduct design research. They had a great deal of difficulty finding such resources. We were able to hook them up with faculty in our Institute of Technology. And as a result of that very productive collaboration, Victory Systems is now building a production plant in Minnesota. And the CEO projects that they will have hundreds, and he was talking 200 to 300 jobs in the next 3 to 5 years. If this research was not being done at the University of Minnesota, this would have located in Wisconsin or Michigan or where else the research was located. Coloplast is a Danish company that markets healthcare products. They chose to relocate in Minneapolis, and the access to the university and the availability of well-trained workforce here was identified by the founders and the CEOs as the major factor in their decision. To date, Coloplast has hired 130 employees and expects to hire an additional 40 in the next year. And finally, on a small scale and a newer scale, is NISO's Health is a new local startup company that had a great idea but had difficulty in finding ways to conceptualize the device they were trying to develop and to define what the market for that device might be. They've worked with people at the university and have actually overcome both of those hurdles. They now occupy laboratory space in the University Enterprise Laboratory in St. Paul and are poised to start clinical trials on their medical device. And they are located here because the University of Minnesota is here. Finally, let me wrap it up by saying that the question of does a research university contribute to the economy of a region, I think you could get all sorts of opinions. I think most would agree it does. But I would say I think if you just look at what other state legislatures are doing, you will get an assessment of what they think in that regard. And I will tell you, I've listed several states here, California, New York, Arizona, Texas, Wisconsin, Ohio, and New Jersey. This is not an all-inclusive list. This is just a list of the initiatives I'm aware of off the top of my head, in which the state legislature is placing a very large investment in research at their major research university. And it is my contention, and I'm happy to hear that Tom Simpson also mentioned this in his comments, that I think, you know, for Minnesota, to keep its competitive edge, to change the trends that we've heard about this morning, it's going to be very important that we partner with the state in funding future strategic investments in research with an eye of really securing the future for the state of Minnesota. So with that, I'd be happy to end my comments and would be willing to respond to any questions you might have.
Okay. Specific questions? Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Vice President Mulcahy, you and I have had many conversations, and I will compliment you on your on the improvements that you've made on your technology transfer. You have a ways to go, but everyone does, so it's not a complete criticism. It's just kind of a compliment, but encouraging you to go on. But my question... University of Minnesota, its research and development funds are approximately $619 million. When the state was, when the university was on that upward path, starting in the 70s and middle 70s and 80s of really being a high-flying research and research institute, if and you may, I hope you have this answer, if that dollar figure that was spent then, adjusted for inflation, would it total $620 million? Would it be lower? Would it be higher? Do you have a figure on what that would be?
Representative Mahoney, let me first thank you for the compliment. I'm more than happy to accept that on behalf of the university. Specifically with request response to that question, what I have done in the past is actually have modeled that growth rate what on a couple of scenarios. What would happen if we had continued to grow at the rate that we were growing in the period you referenced? If that growth had continued, we would be greater than we are at $619 million. There are a lot of reasons to question the assumption that you would be able to maintain that growth no matter who you are, as a university for that prolonged period of time. Nonetheless, it would be greater. The other thing that I have modeled is if we actually grew at a more modest rate, which was intermediate between that rapid growth period and what has been reported as a lag period in the last 10 years or so, we would be a little better than we are now. But one of the things I'm happy to say, and I think this is a reflection of the efforts we're making at the university through strategic positioning, but also efforts we're doing through my office with President Brunick's strong encouragement, that is to reach out to corporate sponsors of research throughout the state and be more amenable and accessible and a better partner with them. What we've seen in the last 2 years is a significant improvement in the growth rate of our research portfolio. Such that in 2006, the last year for which we have the standardized numbers from the federal government, the growth rate in our research portfolio was the second best in the country, private or public.
So we're doing things to try to turn that trend around, but if there had not been whatever occurred in some of those intervening years, we probably would be further along. The other comment I would make to you is it would just be a comment with regard to the illusion that you made that, you know, in the 70s when we were an elite university, implying that at this point in time we may not be. I would just restate that the University of Minnesota in the last ranking ranks ninth in terms of its research status among the public research universities and 17th in the nation of all universities in its research portfolio. So we are still an elite research institution. We might have been higher in the rankings than we are now, but I don't want to leave you with the impression that we are no longer in the league with the elites.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I need to go to Representative Carlson, then we have...
Okay, I was very, very quick here. You were correct. I do apologize for the implication there. I would highly recommend to the committee to read the report that Dr. Stenson referred to, because the answers to those questions are in there. They are startling. It's like a $400 million difference. And
if you apply, if I may, if you apply that conservative estimate from the U.S. Department of Commerce, or if you look at the number of, well, I guess that would be at the number of jobs that that translates to, it's a phenomenal number. So the difference, what happened in the past, had an adverse impact on the university, which I think we're seeing now as well. Thank you, Representative Mahoney.
Okay, that's Senator Carlson.
Now, Chair, just I have a question. It wasn't too many years ago that the goal in Minnesota was to be in the top five. Major public research institutions, and we just haven't been going in that direction, even though, as you point out, we maintain a relatively high ranking. We never achieved that goal of respect, I think, during the years of Ken Keller and others, president. But my question, was at a meeting the other day with Dr. Stinson, maybe he touched on this. I unfortunately was in another meeting and missed the presentation today. But the amount of investment by the corporate sector, what the table that he showed me the other day, was way down. And if you care to comment, just part of the discussion I think here was the public investment, but corporate investment is way down as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, that is absolutely correct. And look, I can elaborate just briefly on that. If you take our research portfolio, of the $620 million, you can look at individual categories of funding. One, for example, the most obvious is federally sponsored research. Well, we do well in that category. We'd love to do better. But if you look at various other categories, one of them is corporate sponsored research, as you mentioned. We are relatively low in that category, and relative to our peers, those that we identify as the institutions we want to measure ourselves against, we are near the bottom of the pack. Now, I would say that there's many factors that contribute to that, but since I've been here, one of the things we focused on in a great deal is, in fact, trying to learn from the corporate community what it is that they feel is a hindrance, if that's the case, to their working with the university. And we are seeing improvements in that regard. The university this last year opened an academic and corporate relations center with a specific goal of connecting the corporate community with whatever resource they need within the university in a timely, responsive way. That has been received extremely well, and I'm happy to boast that this year at the Techni Awards offered by the Minnesota High Tech Association, the Academic and Corporate Relations Center received the 2007 award for Collaborative Innovation of the Year. We're looking at ways to reduce our administrative hassle of working with companies, and we are more proactive in marketing our assets with our local companies. And I think you'll see a turnaround in those numbers. It's one of my personal objectives, because I think we do need closer public-private partnerships. I would think, to be fair to this body, to point out that I mentioned several of the initiatives in other states that I listed there. Many of those initiatives are, in fact, initiatives designed specifically to forge public-private partnership. It's not simply, here's a lot of money.
So there are opportunities, I think, that exist for working with our corporate partners in the state of Minnesota in their interest, in the interest of the university, in the interest of the people of Minnesota, and we're striving to do that. But you're absolutely correct in saying that's an area for improvement.
And just one last quick one. A number of years ago, I was quite involved with bringing up the PUF funds to create the Massachusetts for endowed chairs. And are there things that could be done to encourage more corporate involvement? Because that generated, I think, within a very short period of time, one of the best fundraising initiatives the university had ever had. I think they raised some millions within a very short time after we released the PUF funds. And that was, for members that may not be familiar with that, that's the Permanent University Fund. And we used to take that as the legislature as an offset on their appropriation.
Mm-hmm.
We allowed the university to keep it with a commitment to do matching for endowed chairs. And that's what generated that huge investment. So if you could comment, I guess my question was longer than I thought, but Madam Chair,
I hope people won't mind if we go a little longer than our schedule ending, because I would like to bring back the panel to interact with each other. Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, that's a very, very good point. And I can tell you, I mentioned it in my own presentation, a number of studies looking at the impact of a university on the economy of a region find in common the importance of outstanding faculty. A lot of things move away from the universities, you know, technology, students, and there are ways to mitigate that, but having a strong faculty is a key part. And so the funds from the PUF funds to allow us to endow chairs was critical. And one of the things that I believe very strongly, and I'm a vice president of the university industry partnership, which is sponsored by the National Academy of Sciences and is working to try to find ways to help universities and industry work better together. One of the things that's very evident from our discussion with our national corporate partners is the benefits that accrue to universities through a solid partnership with their corporate partners extends beyond licensing of technology. It goes to things like support for professorships that are so vital to universities. So we need to look for ways of partnering, and we've done it very well with our corporate partners, but we need to strengthen that, and certainly the PUF funds have been an important part of our ability to do that.
Thank you. Okay, let me bring up one more person, and then we'll hopefully have a little bit of extended. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Okay, Jennifer Schaumbach is going to bring in another factor of this equation.
Yeah.
Please state your name and where you're from and so forth.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Ruth Dina. My name is Jennifer Schaumbach. I am the Legislative Director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO. Economic issues are now Minnesota's working families' biggest concern. They are feeling the effects of fewer good-paying jobs, rising health care costs, and higher property taxes on their pocketbooks. JobNow's latest report, The Cost of Living in Minnesota, figures the cost of basic needs, which need food, housing, health care, child care, clothing, and transportation, for different types of families in all 13 economic regions. They also figure the share of jobs in each region that pay less than a family-supporting wage. The basic needs standard is based upon what's needed for no-frills standard of living, which means there's no money included for debt payments, skills training, no entertainment budget, no restaurant meals, no going out to eat, no vacations, and nothing for emergencies, retirement, or children's education, college education. In the report, they found that each worker in a Minnesota family of four, with both parents working, would have to earn at least $12.24 an hour to meet basic needs. But by looking at waste data collected by deed, we find that 37% of the jobs in Minnesota, that's more than 1 million jobs, pays less than a family-supporting wage of $12.24 per hour. At $6.15 per hour, a couple with two children living in Minnesota would have to work almost four full-time minimum wage jobs, or 159 hours a week, just to meet basic needs. It is unlikely that wage growth will accelerate in this climate, and more likely that both hourly wage growth and average hours will slow. If so, the combination of faster inflation and steady or slowing wage growth will reduce the buying power of many workers. This, in turn, has the potential to slow consumer spending, a key factor that has until now been driving the economy forward. Job quality is affected by job quantity. The Minnesota Job Vacancy Survey shows that over the last 6.5 years, the number of job openings in the state has gone down by 58%. Meanwhile, the number of job seekers, unemployed workers, has shifted even more dramatically in the opposite direction, going up by 64%. With 133,000 unemployed workers now competing for only 60,000 unfilled jobs, job seekers outnumber jobs by more than 2-to-1. As Sue Moreau referenced, there are now 17,000 people who are on long-term unemployment, so more than 26 weeks of unemployment, so they are not counted in the current unemployment statistics. Eroding benefits have devastated many workers and their families. As health care costs continue to soar, more and more employers are shifting costs onto Minnesota workers who are in no position to shoulder them. Dwindling retirement assets are also worsening the economic situation for working families. Fewer than half of all workers have an employer-provided retirement plan of any sort. The economic problems facing workers and their families are not purely accidental, nor are they the result of some failure on the part of the workers to take the initiative to get ahead on their own. They are the direct result of a specific set of unrestricted free market economic policies that have only benefited corporations, corporate executives, and the wealthy. We need to ensure that the economy exists to serve the needs of the people. We need a plan for the state that calls for growing the economy by investing in the skills employees need to succeed today. We must also reconnect with several important working family values that resonate powerfully with all of us. Those include: anyone who wants to work should have a job. All workers and their families should be able to live in dignity with health care and retirement security. Every worker should enjoy the freedom to form a union and bargain collectively. Working families want to contribute to and share in building a world-class economy. So here's what we can do right now. We need to pass a comprehensive transportation funding bill. We need to pass a large bonding bill as soon as possible. We need to pass a tax bill restoring cuts to local government aid. We need to raise the minimum wage. And we need to provide adequate funding for K-12 and higher education. Minnesota's working families deserve an economy that restores their hopes. Realizing this goal should be the legislature's main concern this year. Thank you for your time, and I stand for any questions. Thank you. I think we'll bring, unless there are very specific questions at this point, I think we'll bring up, we thought if we have our three economists in front and then the supporting staff in the right there to be able to do questions, we can try. First, I guess I'd like to ask if there's any interaction, if any one of the presenters or Tom Paul would like to ask any question to each other.
Madam Chairman, I'd like to make one comment in response to Vice President Mulcahy's remark that economists would cringe when he quoted that statistic. I believe what he's actually quoting is a multiplier from the Department of Commerce Regional Impact Multiplier System, and that number only measures the current impact in jobs of, if you put an extra $1 million into that, it doesn't measure the jobs that might be created in the future by technology or anything. It's just the spin-off of jobs as a result of that activity. So in that sense, he's underselling, and I didn't cringe at all.
Any other questions and issues? And, you know, the people, like assuming Jennifer aren't there, can are perfectly able to jump up and say something if they want to.
And Madam Chairman, we certainly don't want to exclude the women from this panel in any way.
Well, I can ask that leads me to ask Mr. Mulcahy, since he talked about the importance of STEM
of the STEM program is that maybe he can give me the numbers of what proportion of those STEM students are women and what proportion of the STEM faculty are women. I don't know if you have that at your fingertips right now.
Madam Chair, we can certainly get you those numbers. I think I would rather not hazard a guess. It's not directly in my line of responsibility, but we will get you those numbers, and I can tell you, I think the university does extremely well in those categories.
Madam Chair?
Representative,
you know, Mr. Anton, I think you kind of touched a little bit on it in your presentation about tax, you know, increases, spending cuts, shifts, a combination of everything.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my question to you or Dr. Simpson would be, to what extent, you know, did the Governor Fuentes' decision in 2003 to keep a no new tax pledge and a deficit that had actually increased, doubled from what we were projecting at the time, to what extent did that have any effect on the things we're talking about today as far as the economy slowing down? Certainly on the research, it had an effect with the huge cuts to our higher education system, I think, to the tune of $300 some million. But maybe I'm way off base, and I want to blame this on the governor. So go ahead, Ben.
Tom, it's great that he let me agree to answer that question. If questions come up about my CEO, I certainly would be glad to have Tom answer them. Madam Chairman, Representative Rukavina, we can't quantify precisely what the impact is, but I would argue that the impact, in line with what I was saying about investment, you can quantify that the real resources going to education, K-12 and higher education, are both lower than they were in real terms before that change in the state's budget. So there definitely is some impact. We can't quantify how much that is. I would argue, in line with what we said, that most of the impact is stuff that would be felt in the future rather than you could look today and see and trace something. So I believe there is some, but it's part of the general viewpoint. And as far as the no new taxes pledge, I don't know that one could quantify exactly what the impact of that was on education spending per se, and the shifting, but since education is such a large part of the state's budget, it definitely is the case that it would have been hard to maintain the real level of education spending while having that as an overarching principle for the budget as a whole. So that you had a choice within those parameters, I guess, and I know the trade-offs are tough. You certainly don't want to start lowering spending on things like bridge maintenance or something, so I wouldn't want to claim that it's easy to make those trade-offs.
You know, one common theme that I picked up from everyone, including Ms. Moreau and Ms. Selbach, was this investment in training and investment in skills, which seems, I think almost everyone used that phrase somewhere in it. Anyone have any ideas of specifics on that? Or is it just kind of doing more of what we have done? Or does anyone know of any programs that are worldwide that are more successful than what we seem to be doing?
Madam Chair, I don't have any real specifics, but let me kind of sketch out what I think the appropriate approach is. Investment in human capital, which is what we're talking about, has a payoff to the individual. It also has a payoff to the firm, and it has a payoff to the state. And we have to somehow figure out a mechanism so that we can facilitate that investment in human capital that's necessary later on, you know, post-secondary. Capital markets don't necessarily work perfectly. You can borrow to buy a front end loader or a backhoe more easily than you can borrow to come back into the market, into the educational facility and pay for your living expenses. And so we've got to adjust somehow. And it's not just a pure public program. It's got to be some kind of facilitation for all that's important to us.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As far as funding for education, you know, according to the statistic I gave earlier, we're going to be missing 10% of our traditional students from K-12 institutions going into higher ed. Doesn't it logically mean that that way we have to account for those when we look at funding for K-12 education, that we are now spending either 10% more per student to educate them K-12, or we have to somehow adjust our spending, either agree that we're spending 10% more without spending 10% more, or say that those students aren't being taught. Do we have to pay for students that aren't there, in other words? And that's something that business people tell me all the time. We're spending more and more for public education, and I agree that it's necessary. At the same time, we are paying for students that aren't there.
Madam Chairman, Representative Gunther, I've encountered the calculus of education spending also as head of the Financial Advisory Committee to the Bloomington Schools, and looked at, you know, there are 17 or 27 different pots of money that go into running a school system, as you know, and you're probably more conversant with all of them than I. But one thing that is an ongoing problem with the way we fund schools, we fund education, is that by funding on an average cost basis, any particular school or school district where headcount shrinks will almost inevitably have a reduction in the quality of the education there, because we don't price at what economists call marginal cost. And so the result is that if you had a school and it lost 30 students, which roughly, let's say, would be what would be taught by, let's say, one teacher, you would lose funding of foundation aid of, say, $4,600 last time I looked, something like that, or $138,000, which would mean you would cut one teacher and then have another, say, at $40,000, and then have another $98,000 to cut out of the budget. So at the micro level, what it means is that we lost maybe $30,000 of cost, but that school lost much more in the way of funding. So even in terms of the way we allocate existing funds, in a system where the headcount will be shrinking, not just in a few schools, but at most of them demographically, we need to think about a different way to fund so that we don't reduce the quality of education inadvertently, not by intent, but simply because of the way we fund that. If the actual dollar volume were to hold up as the number of students declined by 10%, and the dollar volume adjusted for inflation, I might add, then we would have more resources per child. One of the things involved in the historical data, which shows an increase, I think could be explained by the fact that the number of students with special needs, or I'm sure you've heard school superintendents say there are 130 languages spoken in our district, where there used to be one or three, all add to the cost. So making the adjustments for that is a challenge to do in an honest way. But that's also part of the historical cost increase. I don't know exactly how much.
Madam Chairman, I think I agree with you, although it's a little bit above my head. But the answer that I usually get from the staff at the schools in my district is a real simple one. If we lose 30 students and we have 30 classes, that's one student per class. You cannot cut anything losing one student per class. And that's very true. And you look at it from the state perspective, from a macro sense, Minneapolis lost 3,000 students one year. They certainly could cut classes. but Grenada Huntley East Chain couldn't do that. Thank you.
That makes it even worse.
It does.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a question for Mr. Gillespie, and the because I think these are the slides that he talked about on page 4 of the handout. Competitions for future workforce will increase, and migration increases in importance as labor force growth slows. I'm looking at the first slide there as this competition for the workforce. And I'm trying to figure out, are you saying that over from 2005 to 2010, Minnesota will have it's got a negative 1.2. Are you saying that we will have less of a need for a workforce, or we're going to be in more competition? Could you explain that just a little bit more, and then I've got a question for the next slide.
Madam Chair, Representative Levine, the graphic here is looking at the 18 to 24 year old age population, and this is largely the population that is either going on to higher education or starting their careers. And what we are seeing nationally is that we expect to see a national decline in the number of young people entering this age group, 18 to 24. Our neighbors are already experiencing the decline, and Minnesota is about to experience the decline in the 18 to 24. Our age structure is very similar to the national age structure, so it's a fairly similar kind of situation. Now, part of that is that we do lose some young people to colleges outside of state, so there's a slightly more young people leave the state to go to college elsewhere than come here. Institutes of higher education have been there's the previous the graphic that is shown that is shown on the prompter. As you can see, for the 15 to 19 year old, we expect to lose more than 29,000 young people over roughly the next 10 years, and that is part and parcel of this. This is a relatively smaller cohort of people, and our high school graduation class is going to peak over the next couple years and then decline for about a decade after that. Institutes of higher education look at this and see a situation where there's going to be an increasing competition for excellent students, an increased competition nationwide, so that institutions in our neighboring states and other states around the country are already beginning to compete and look at Minnesota's best and brightest here, and we're beginning to look at their best and brightest. And part of what this game is about is the competition for talent. And the winner of the competition for talent, if we can bring people, have a net inflow of people, keep our best and brightest, bring bright young people to Minnesota. In addition, then we will have a larger talent pool. Many of these young people will stay here after they finish their education, and we would have a larger talent pool to draw from that would accelerate economic growth. This is also for the young people that don't go on to higher education, who stop at high school or with a year or two of college. That number will also be declining, and that says something about the immediate growth in the workforce, which is slowing down. We have to remember that this is happening at the very same time that we have a large number of people that are approaching retirement. that we have a rapidly increasing number of people reaching their 62nd birthday this year. Between 62 and 63 is the average age at which Minnesotans and Americans retire, at least up to this point. That may be delayed a little bit with the economy, but it's not going to be delayed forever. We will begin to see this change. So we'll have more people leaving and fewer young people entering, which gets us to this graphic. And here the red bar represents this difference between young people entering and old people leaving the workforce. That has been, for nearly a century, our largest source of growth in the workforce, and that is about to come to a screeching halt, not just in Minnesota, but nationwide. And that only leaves two other sources of growth in the workforce, one of which is increased participation rate, which we have already factored in an increased rate for older workers. We've already factored in that we believe that the participation rate for older workers, that they will continue to stay in the workforce a little longer. Maybe the retirement age will go up a little bit. We may be underestimating that. We don't know yet. Because it hadn't happened yet. We may be overestimating it. It may not happen to the extent that we expect, but there is good reason to believe that we will see an increase there. And then there's only one other source of growth to the workforce, and that's people moving here from other states and other countries. And that is much less certain. That depends not just on what is happening here, and the demand for jobs here, but also what is happening worldwide. And already we're beginning to see, for example, some reductions in immigration from countries like India, where there are more job opportunities now in India than there were earlier in the decade. And you know, people are staying home. They are taking advantage of those job opportunities, and we're seeing fewer people from India moving to the United States and to Minnesota. India has been, for most of this decade, the third largest source of immigrants to Minnesota. And I think that's one of those sort of quiet transitions that we have seen over the last decade, is the movement of people from India and from China and from other places of the world, worldwide. But as opportunities in their home countries improve, as educational opportunities improve, as job opportunities improve, they're less likely to make this international jump that would be required to move to Minnesota. And so in part there's going to be greater competition with other countries as they also change, and in part our ability to attract people depends not just on what's happening here and whether we're generating jobs and the quality of those jobs and the quality of the living environment and also the quality of schools for their children is a factor. But it also depends on what happens everywhere else in the United States and the world.
One thing that we haven't had a lot of discussion about is the parts of our society, particularly that 18 to 24-year-old that we kind of throw away, and that's the from the Latino community, the Native American community, and the African American community, or the Black community in general. I mean, aren't we? What about things that can be done to have them become more participating in the upward mobility instead of, you know, I'm not sure that the directions have been in the wrong direction.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is a fairly simplistic view, this graph of high school graduation rates. Adding an additional complexity to this would be to divide it by gender. And here we see very large differences. I don't have that graph in front of me, but we have very large differences by gender. Many people have noted this, that it's the young men who largely are not graduating from high school. And there's a difference across all races, though the differences in the Latino and African American community is a bit larger. The high school graduation rate for Black or African American youth in Minnesota, according to the U.S. Department of Education, and I believe this is for 2003 data, But you know, I'm trying to remember this off the top of my head, but we ranked in the bottom 10 of states. And for Latino or Hispanic students, we ranked in the bottom 15 of states. We do not rank highly in the graduation rates for Black or African American and for Latino students. There is not a national comparison on American Indians since many states have relatively small populations. So it's sort of a numbers base. But while we rank highly overall in our high school graduation rate, we don't rank necessarily very highly there. But there also there's additional steps beyond this, and part of this is all it also reflects not just in the proportion graduating from high school, but also the proportion going on to higher education opportunities. And the percent of those young people who actually complete a bachelor's degree. And in all those stages, we see substantial differentials by race and ethnicity and also by gender.
Madam Chairman, you know, this is just a tragedy.
Yeah.
And it's a tragedy because of the lost opportunity that we have here. I mean, there are direct costs because people aren't graduating from high school, they're more apt to be on the public dole and things like that, but there's an opportunity cost that we have, that is, these people could have achieved more and aren't achieving more, and, you know, the tragedy looking out further into the future is that the growth areas of the 5 to 18-year-olds, the place where we're going to have more and more students, are in the minority area, and so this is if this change isn't arrested, you know, if we don't make a change in these graduation rates, our overall graduation rate is going to drop. I mean, that's the tragedy that we have there.
And Mr. Stinson and I have talked extensively about the concept of first principle. And many economists and historians and political leaders of Minnesota have long pointed to the role of education in our success. And there's good reason to believe that that has been a major factor in the success, the remarkable success of Minnesota. And so if we, going forward from here, our future prosperity depends very much upon how well we educate young people today. That is a real concern.
Madam Chairman, if I may add, a good portion of my work at Wilder Research involves doing benefit cost analysis of human services programs of different types. And so there's a developing field where we're starting to quantify more of the effects that we may have understood at a kind of anecdotal or informal level, and replacing that with analysis that makes things more concrete and makes it easier to judge the benefits versus the costs of certain kinds of activities. One number that I remember that we used in a study of youth intervention programs and mentoring programs recently, Judy Temple at the University of Minnesota and I, was that the present value of graduating from high school versus not graduating from high school. The best estimate I've seen of that is by Cecilia Rouse at Harvard at $263,000 at this point, not over your life, but converted to today's dollars. So each time a student doesn't graduate, it's $250,000 out of this stream of income. A portion of that is the taxes that would be paid to the state of Minnesota and to other entities as well. Out of that, I actually have $263,000 is the return to the student. In addition, the return to the taxes are added onto that, I believe.
Okay. Representative Ruth?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jumping to the minimum wage, I'm just wondering what research we have, or if we have research on what the age group is, are they largely part-time, or how many are full-time, and who is this workforce in the particular the age group?
Okay.
Madam Chair, like the Department of Employment and Economic Development has those business program rules, but I don't know if anybody's even here from the Department of Employment.
Okay.
Chair, perhaps they have some knowledge they can shed on this.
Mr. Bob, take my time.
Madam Chair, Bob Isaacson with the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. I don't have those numbers available today, but I will forward those numbers to you and distribute to the members.
You got it, sir?
There's their own number. Correct.
Yeah.
Well, this is from the Department of Labor and Industry, which is similar from the current population statistics of federal survey.
Is it in that department?
Workers earning at or below $6.15 an hour, 14.9% are between 15 and 18 years old, which represents and then 2024, 5.3% of all, I should say all workers, as I'm looking at this chart for the first time. Let me recharacterize this. Of the workers earning $6.50 an hour or less, and they're between 15 and 18 years old, they represent 23% of the minimum wage workers. 20 to 24-year-old workers represent 14.2% of minimum wage workers. 25 to 54 represent about 22% of minimum wage workers, and 55 and older represent about 6% of minimum wage workers.
Representative Bruce? Thank you. And just as a follow-up, are these part-time positions? Are they full-time? Is that in there?
This does not indicate whether it's full-time or part-time, but we can certainly look more into that. We have some information on distribution of part-time and full-time workers, and I'm happy to forward some of that information that would also associate with the wage levels.
Thank you. Okay, I think if anyone has any last comments, questions, or points, this is obviously an ongoing discussion.
Madam Chair, I have a couple more questions for Dr. Simpson, but I don't want to get him in trouble. So.
Did you have your impeachment resolution going?
I'll ask them after.
Okay. Anything for any members who are here, remind you to do your blue sheets and get them into the front so we can take care of those. And thank you so much for coming. And thank you for agreeing to stay beyond the time we told you.
Almost got it.